Welcome back to the Iowa Blog. I'm your host, Craig Wynn. And on this program, we're going to return to the garden. It's about a 6,000-year journey back in time, but the effort will be well worth it. This is our third episode on describing what Iowa had to say about this remarkable place. And our journey back in time is for a lot of reasons, and one of which is this is where we are returning. Yes, we are going back to the past. Iowa is restoring the conditions found in the Garden of Eden upon the entire earth, and will do so immediately upon his return on Yom Kippurim in year 6000, October 2nd, 2033, and will begin to celebrate the 1,000-year time of camping out together, the millennial Shabbat, on the 7th of October, 2033. This being year 6000, So we read that the tree of lives, Etz HaChamim, of renewals and restorations, was in the center or middle midst of the sheltered garden, the Gan, along with the tree of the knowledge, the HaDeath, of good, Tob, and Ra, so by contrast, bad, of that which is beneficial and proper, and that which is contradictory to our interest and improper, favorable and desirable, of course, unfavorable and undesirable. Tob and Ra. This is interesting because, first of all, the tree of lives was Chaim plural. That means that there would be more than one life that is being afforded to those who have the opportunity to eat from it. The first life is our mortal existence. The second is our opportunity to spend time in Yahweh's home, in Shamaim, with our Heavenly Father. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil is mostly presented by the religious as this thing that was really bad. It was a forbidden fruit that was on this tree. It doesn't actually mention fruit. And he doesn't say that it was even forbidden. It is a tree of the knowledge of good and bad. Now, in the condition that the two inhabitants of the garden were in, and at this point there was only Adam, but soon there would be also Chawa, all he knew was life. Life was perfect. Life for him would have been eternal. So there would have been no benefit for him to eat of the tree of lives. He was already enjoying life to its fullest. And there would be no benefit for him to have consumed anything from the tree of the knowledge of good and bad. He knew good. And at this point, there was no bad inside of the garden. So knowing the bad that was transpiring outside of the garden and that would consume the planet thereafter was of no value to him. So there were all of these trees, probably millions of them, that were appropriate for Adam to eat from, as Yahweh said. And these two trees would have had no merit, no value to them, to Adam whatsoever. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't have value to us, because they do. The tree of lives now is represented by the Shamak, the great branch, who is Dod, the Messiah and Son of God, our Savior. He is grafted into this tree and reaches out to us so that we can be benefit along with him and enjoy a forever life. It is why he was nailed to a wooden pole, using the same word as Etz, and why he opened, through fulfilling Pesach, the doorway to eternal life, providing us with the restoration of life and a second life, one that is eternal. It is now essential for us to know both good and bad. Dod wrote about it vociferously, and it is one of my missions to help people understand it, because you're really not in a position to capitalize on that which is good until you disassociate yourself from that which is bad. And you are likely not to know what is raw unless it is explained to you, particularly in relation to God, because there's this prevalent misconception that religion and politics are both good things. But from Yahweh's perspective, they epitomize evil. They are the ultimate at being harmful and corrupting. So today it's important for you to know how Yahweh defines that which is harmful and corrupt, morally inappropriate and malignant, so that you can avoid it and capitalize on that which is good. This is from Bereshith in the beginning, 2:9. Well, in what will ultimately become a referendum on choice, we will learn that the Tree of Lives provides us with the potential to associate with God and live forever. We are given the Chaim, Nesama, life-restoring and restraint and sustaining conscience, so that each nefesh soul might choose eternal existence. To achieve that, to make a reasoned decision, to properly exercise free will and be appropriately judgmental, we not only require this neshama, conscience, that Yahweh uniquely gave to Adam and therefore to all humankind, but we also must be aware of the alternatives, one of which leads to renewed life by embracing what Father and Son accomplished at Pesach, Matzah, and Makkudim, but the other results in death. The Tree of Lives lives and yields a either wonderful resort, or if you are just nourished by the evil of the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, well, you can also have an extended time separated from God in Sheol. There are the possibility of two ongoing lives. There is also the possibility that the Tree of Lives is indicative, as I've shared, of the upright pillar upon which Dod would be affixed during his fulfillment of Pesach as he was crucified by the Romans. The Etz Timber of Chaim, restored and sustained lives, provides the doorway of life. And this is opened during Passover. Through it, we return to fellowship with God, and we return to Eden. It is at the center of the garden enclosure, because the upright pillar is central to Yahweh's plan of reconciliation. It is central to the source of eternal life, the better of these two choices. Now, Dayath, which is knowledge in this particular case, is a derivative of Yada. Yada is the verbal form, which means to know in a relational sense, to be acquainted with, to consider, to perceive, to discriminate, to distinguish, to recognize, to acknowledge. When it comes to God, the more one Dayath knows, the more likely one will come to Yada, Yahweh. And from this perspective, I suspect that the two trees are indicative of the two luminaries that Yahweh spoke of on the fourth day of creation. Dod represents the Tree of Lives, while Yada serves to present copious amounts of information on the benefits intended by the relationship, while also criticizing the negative influence of religion and politics. This is very consistent with Dod's writings, as well as with Yahweh's style. He actually spends as much time, if not more, discussing and warning us about the things that are harmful to us, as he does that which is nurturing and is beneficial to us and nurturing. And while Dod and Yada are both conduits for knowledge, information about the proper perspective and associations, should you be devoid of a conscience and fail to exercise good judgment, you can become arrogant, you can become self-reliant, you can go off on a branch that leads in the wrong direction. Alone, unconnected to the source of life, knowledge has caused many men to believe that they are all that matters and that they have all the answers. Some even come to think that they are responsible for life and death and try to impose death on those who disagree with them. A few consider themselves to be gods. In this light, Satan has dayeth, knowledge of God's existence, and yet he does not yada, know Yahweh in a familial way. Dayeth, knowledge, and our nesama, conscience, the ability to be discerning, discriminating, judgmental, and moral, are collaborative. One without the other has very little value. They are prerequisites of meaningful choice, of justice, of morality and wisdom, even of logic and reason. To a large degree, the progressive political religion has interceded by indoctrinating a generation or two of Europeans and Americans so that they are unwilling or even incapable of exercising good judgment. Dedicated, devoted to simply responding to platitudes without thinking. And it does not matter how much liberty you are afforded. If you can't make an informed decision, render a wise choice, execute moral judgment, deliver a just verdict, reach a reasoned conclusion, then your conscience is useless to you, as are all freedoms. So one must know the facts before you can process information in a reasonable and logical way so that we use our conscience to be discriminating and judgmental and come to a reasoned decision. It is through making connections that we transition from knowledge to understanding and arrive at reasoned conclusions regarding the evidence that is before us. This is the very essence of Yada Yahweh and of the Torah. The message then is quite simple. A person who elects to disregard Yahweh's Torah guidance, as religious Jews do in favor of their Talmud, as Christians do as a result of Paul's perverted letters, and as a consequence of the Gospels that he inspired, they are deprived of the information needed to survive their morality or mortality. There is a direct connection between dayeth, knowledge, and life in association with God. You have to know him to trust him. You have to understand what he's offering and expecting in return to engage in a relationship with him. We come to God by thinking. Now, what I'm about to share resonates with very few people. Hoping that perhaps there will be more, let's ponder something that I think is profound. The reason there is no longer any hope for the world as a whole, only one in a million individuals are going to benefit from the lessons that we are sharing on this program and end up in a relationship with God. It is because egocentric and greedy, conscienceless, religious and political men and women have deliberately corrupted both sides of the dayeth, knowledge, and neshama, conscience, equation. In progressive nations and in totalitarian societies, like those found in fascist, socialist, and Islamic countries, access to information is constrained, such that what little is available is often inaccurate propaganda. Without access to good data, reason is of marginal utility. Making wide choices is essentially impossible. This is one of the things that progressives are trying to accomplish in the internet, where they want to shut down freedom of speech. That's why they have such a conniption fit over Elon Musk, because he encourages freedom of speech, and why they are so infatuated with other platforms that have put thought police in place to restrict freedom of speech. Although, as I understand it, most recently, Mr. Zuckerberg has decided that maybe they went way too far on constraining free speech and has now opened up Facebook in particular so that you can share the truth, even if the truth isn't popular. The masses are therefore being controlled by robbing people of their ability to choose wisely between man and God, between good and bad, between right and wrong. And for this reason, liberal elitists have created the immoral code. It's a replacement moral code, if you will, called political correctness. Don't use the term much anymore because it's been replaced by cancel culture and woke and being progressive. But it is still the underlying moral code of these human religious schemes. And it has recently become even more debilitating because of the aforementioned thought police on social media and the imposition of both woke ideology and cancel culture that have no correlation whatsoever between them and reality, nor do they have any advantage for anyone. Based upon the irrational notion of being intolerant of intolerance, actually the most hateful people in the world are progressives, it makes being judgmental and thus being discerning and discriminating a crime, which is probably why most progressives are hypocrites but don't even know it. No matter how prevalent or accurate the facts are, without the ability to process them judgmentally, to be discerning and discriminating, reasoned conclusions and thus good choices are impossible. As a result, men and women have abrogated their free will, as almost everyone on the planet has been rendered unable to rationally process truth based upon the consequence of these counterproductive human schemes. Progressive political correctness, now labeled woke, cancel culture, has become the moral code of Western universities, of the media, of politics, and for society in general. It is the ignorant and irrational soul of America's socialist secular humanist, the doctrine of liberalism. And make no mistake, it is a control mechanism, just as has been religion over the past 6,000 years. It's designed to condition the masses so that they are easier to manipulate, indoctrinate, control, and fleece. Now, in this regard, I can and have provided mountains of evidence proving conclusively that the religions of man, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, and now progressive socialist secular humanism, are wrong. But it makes no difference to those who are unable to process that evidence rationally. I can and have provided overwhelming proof that Yahweh exists, and that he revealed his covenant in the Torah and prophets, explaining what he's offering and expects. But it seldom resonates with those who have been poisoned by cults and conspiracies. I can and have revealed the fate that awaits humankind between now and the fall of 2033. And yet, without motivating people to change because their consciences are no longer engaged, it has marginal utility. And one of the things that I've learned is that very few people now will invest the energy or time or even have the capacity to read. And I have changed my approach from spending 100% of my time translating and contemplating and then writing, sharing what I have learned and the insights I have gleaned, to sharing what I have learned via these video presentations. If I must read to you, if I must come into your home to help you understand what's true, to speak to you in a way that resonates with you, I'll do so because the stakes are high. Your soul is worth it. I don't want you indoctrinated. Once you educated, your opinions mean nothing, but facts processed by good judgment deduce logical and valuable conclusions. Platitudes from pundits now prevail over evidence and reason, but not for everyone. And for those special individuals, we provide the Iowa Blog. I can, and I have, been blocked from presenting God's message on YouTube, Facebook, and even X. Even when what I'm saying is correct and comes from the highest authority, God himself. Truth is now irrelevant in a world controlled by irrational and hypocritical societal influences. Although, it is still where we must exchange ideas. And we'll be here as long as it is possible, providing as much information on your behalf as is allowed. As a result of all of man's political and religious schemes, as they oppress and fleece the masses by controlling access to information or discouraging thoughtfulness, we've come to recognize that during the millennia-long political and religious domination of the Roman Catholic Church, this union of church and state was particularly adept at keeping the masses ignorant and enslaved. The same can be said of communism during the last century. And although most of these periods, throughout most of them, anyone who challenged the edicts of the Catholic or Orthodox Christian Church, a communist or fascist dictator, or an Islamic caliph, was typically tortured and killed. Discernment was not allowed. Truth was never an alibi, because reason is the enemy of all political and religious schemes, all cults and conspiracies. Today in the West, the universal application of the progressive moral code of political correctness assures that anyone in the public arena who is judgmental will be condemned, humiliated, and silenced. You look at how European politicians are lashing out at Elon Musk and saying that he's interfering with their elections. Well, he's providing a forum for free speech, and he is exposing their crimes while standing up on behalf of the victims. And they claim that that is counter to their interest, because it is. Progressives are afraid of free speech because they can't control it and they have nothing to bring to the argument. And so the best of us are condemned as the worst of us by those who are the worst among us. Having traveled in 150 countries, having studied history, I realized that man's legacy is actually abysmal. For nearly 6,000 years across the face of this planet, a malignant concoction of politics and religion has served to enslave the masses for the benefit of clerics and kings. And even that was not enough for an unending cadre of ruthless, egocentric leaders. They always covet more. So with revolting regularity, clerics and kings send their subjects off to war to confiscate more power, more tribute, more territory for themselves. On a global scale, man's history, both ancient and modern, is exceedingly troubling. With only occasional moments of good brightening an otherwise hideous tapestry among nations and large institutions. Given the choice between good and evil, world leaders have chosen to be denigrating and deceptive. Throughout time, the overwhelming preponderance of people have had their freedoms decimated through this mix of controlling schemes, through oppression and fear. Choosing to live outside of the religious and political constructs of these men enjoying such severe consequences, most people abrogate whatever freedom they might have otherwise enjoyed to survive. For those who listen on and actually read the books under the Iowa brand, you will discover that God told us that this would happen. He prophetically predicted that the consequence of the world's hypocritical political and religious leaders, those who say one thing and do another, would be seared beyond recovery. He warned us that while knowledge would increase, man would become increasingly foolish, listening only to those who tell them what they want to hear. To this end, George W. Bush, who I knew reasonably well and disdained, announced that central to making good decisions was being positive. Information and reason have given way to false hope, but such is the nature of religion and politics. Thereby, the crowning achievement in hypocrisy goes to the Nazi-supporting Pope Pius XII, who enabled the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of Orthodox Christians and Jews. By way of our schools and media, an entire generation has been raised to view progressive platitudes and political correctness as an appropriate moral code. They've been taught that man can solve his problems and that science has the answers, even to the conception of life itself. Knowledge apart from the source of our very existence has led to the death and decay of humankind on an unprecedented scale. The more we know, the more foolish and lethal we have become. And this is particularly true now, as progressive young people have joined with Muslims after the hideous atrocities in Israel on 10/7 perpetrated by horrendous and monstrous Muslims. And they're, rather than galvanizing behind and trying to help those who were raped, abducted, tortured, terrorized, and murdered, these thoughtless, immoral progressives are now holding arms with, singing songs alongside, holding placards to acknowledge their support for the perpetrators of those hellish crimes. That's how bad it has become. Now, returning our attention to the text of Bereshith, Genesis 2:9, and moving past Dayat knowledge, Tob is always good. Tob is beneficial and proper, favorable, desirable, agreeable, and pleasing. Tob is moral. It's fair, appropriate, and reasonable, useful, and valuable. The Torah is Tob. Yahweh is Tob. His Bereth and his Mikre are Tob. This floral arrangement to my left, on the right side of your screen, it is entirely Tob. It actually came from our garden. My wife grew these plants, picked them, and made this arrangement that seems to continue to grow. By the time we're into our shows over the weekend, it will probably forest my entire backdrop here, because, well, we're doing a series on In the Garden, and she's going to bring the garden right here. They are lovely. I mean, God was an excellent designer. And my wife has a wonderful relationship with him and an eye for natural beauty. It's Tob. Ra, on the other side of this equation, is being used as a contrast to Tob, which is why I refer to it as bad, good and bad, as opposed to good and evil. Because we're going to do that, it would have to be moral and evil, with Tob being moral, but that would be a distant definition of Tob. But more than this, Ra describes collective evil. And as such, it depicts the influence of harmful and corrupt compatriots, because Ra is also the Hebrew word for neighbor, fellow citizen, associate. So Ra speaks about ideas and actions within a community, within a society, a nation, or institution, which are morally inappropriate, malignant, and disagreeable. Therefore, Ra speaks of religion and politics, the two societal sources of that which is wrong, and a particularly aberrant rhetoric. Ra is the voice and the edicts from the loud mouth associates leading people astray. It addresses all that is wrong with religion and politics. Raw is of no value. It is counterproductive. It is depraved. It is displeasing to God, injurious to us, and troubling to so many. Judaism is raw, as are those it has infected over the ages. The Talmud and Zohar are raw, as are the rabbis who wrote them. This means that Tob and Ra are opposites. They are prosperous and valueless, favorable and harmful, moral and inappropriate, beneficial and malignant, joyous and sad. Behaviors and attitude, ambitious and deeds, doctrines and teachings, even foods can be judged as such and can be placed in one or the other of these categories. And that is the purpose of our Nesama, our seat of judgment, so that we know what is beneficial and what is counterproductive. Yet without access to evil, without a way to reject the good that is God, deprived of the opportunity to choose that which he is not, there would be no way to love. We could not love Yahweh without the opportunity to reject him. Love requires choice. It is the only thing which cannot be manufactured, compelled, or purchased, making love the most valuable and powerful commodity in the universe. Free will, from Yahweh's perspective, is primary, but not the only prerequisite for a loving relationship. A person must also come to Dayath, know their other party as they really are. Otherwise, the emotional response is delusional and can be no deeper than a frivolous fascination. True love requires us to be able to judge whether the potential object of our affection is worthy of this level of trust. And once again, this is the function of our Nesama conscience, which is why Yahweh gave it to us. I'm a fortunate man because my witness on behalf of Yahweh has led me to the great loves of my life: Yahweh and Yehudim, the Torah, Bereth, and Mikre, even to the most fascinating and attractive of all Jewish women, who is sitting over here to my left and one day will become a co-host of this program. There she is, sighing in the background because she's an introvert. There are two additional insights. Obviously, I'm not, so we do pair pretty well in that regard. There are two additional insights that are related to the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, especially with regard to knowing things which are evil, harmful, morally inappropriate, displeasing, and corrupt. Man brought Ra upon himself, which is why Ra describes actions from one's neighbors, from one's fellow citizens, associates, and compatriots. In particular, to be Ra is to be a vocal and local purveyor of religion. In Israel, the most Ra would be the Haredim. And second unto them would be those who religiously pursue liberal and progressive defining politics. They are the two that are tearing Israel apart, and neither has much to contribute. In fact, I'm not sure either of them has anything to contribute. One of the great travesties, as a matter of fact, of 10:7, is that it was progressives who work in the kibbutzim. It was largely progressive young people who went to the rave. Now, this does not infer in any way they had the hell that Muslims unleashed upon them coming. They did not. Islam was wholly to blame. But the mindset of progressives created a false sense of comfort with them, a tolerance of them, so that In the kibbutzim, for example, they brought in these Gazans, whom they would refer to as Palestinians, which is another myth, and to live with them, to help them on their farms, to be a little part of their extended community. And while we're there, as Muslims who hate Jews, they provided intelligence back to Hamas, who used it to kill them. And yet, after all of this, the liberals would still opine for offering a state carved out of the heart of Israel that would reward these very religious monsters for the greatest atrocity in modern history. Rather than saying a loving God wouldn't allow suffering to occur, we should recognize that love requires the choice we humans have made to become acquainted with adversity. Human pain and suffering are a consequence of the choice Adam and Chawa made in the garden and of the subsequent choices we humans make every day. For those who fail to appreciate the purpose of free will or acknowledge its value or consequence, and who continue to lament over a God who allow any atrocity and misfortune to occur on our planet, please consider what you're asking of him. If Yahweh were to intervene to stop anything bad from occurring, the result would be to remove the consequence from choice. Doing so would completely undermine the benefit of free will. It would make love impossible and our very existence pointless. There'd be no reason to the universe, not even for it to be created. Yahweh would no longer be able to grow through loving relationships. There would be no reason to say that stealing was any better or worse than being productive, that lying was any better or worse than telling the truth, that killing was better or worse than life. The idea of God allowing people to choose to be bad rather than follow his instructions is fairly easy to understand. However, when it comes to a child suffering or dying prematurely, it is difficult for us to appreciate how even the most trivial decisions we make can change our futures and those of others. Should God intervene and stop a company from dumping pollutants into the air, the ground, and water to keep a child from getting cancer? And if so, what about altering trivial events which might cause someone to drive a little slower, a little faster on a trip, consume an additional drink, or get distracted when the result leads to an accident? The smallest thing might not only affect the rest of their existence, but also might impact the lives of otherwise innocent bystanders. And even the initial victims of an accident, they do not stand alone. What about the extended family members, the close friends, the coworkers, the neighbors of an accident victim? What if one of those killed would have become a great leader, a doctor, an inventor, a philanthropist, or a rapist, a pedophile, or murderer? And this works the other way as well. There may have been an Austrian with an affinity for painting landscapes who, for some reason, turned down a position on the admissions board at the Vienna Academy of Art. That person who was hired instead rejected an 8-year-old boy's application. In his opinion, the lad's work lacked an appreciation for the human form. How much different the world would be if Adolf Hitler had spent his life drawing cityscapes rather than destroying them. Is that God's fault? Or is the nature of collective man, of humans gathering together as nations and under religious schemes and as empires, when it always seems to bring out the worst in man, gang mentality? Was it the administrator who turned down Adolf Hitler? Was it his or her fault for the war that led, or was it the Roman Catholic Church that created this environment? Was it the socialists who rose in Europe to pretend that they were ultimately wise and better than God? Was it the innate anti-Semitism that's so prevalent in Europe? What was to blame? What ripple was God to stop before it became a tidal wave? Who knows what the confluence of events brings us when a situation that is genuinely horrible happens to an innocent person? You know, I've watched many hours of the devastation that has taken place in the Los Angeles area. And I've listened to the progressives say, oh, well, it's all because of climate change and we're not responsible. BS. They are responsible. Rather than focusing on properly equipping the fire department and of instituting intelligent planning as it relates to clearing brush and the building codes for homes, rather than training properly chosen individuals to serve in the fire department, they spent their money seeing how many lesbians they could hire, seeing how many whites they could replace, seeing how much equity training they could impose, as opposed to teaching them how to run the equipment, how to fight fires. You know, I understand that wildfires are a natural phenomenon, but not urban fires. And when entire neighborhoods are gone, and that you look at it when it was happening, and there were either no fire trucks or no water for those fire trucks to use fire to fight the fires. The problem is the libertards, the progressives, who didn't know what they were doing. And hell was unleashed on the state based upon the choices those in the state had made with their elected officials. This is the reality of the situation we face. We're poorly informed. We lack a good judgment. And we have painted ourselves into a horrible situation so that, well, the equity that the progressives sought, they achieved. Now everyone is homeless. If Yahweh decided to prevent certain bad things from happening, at what point should he stop? If he engages to thwart terminal illness for newborns, at what age does he refrain from intervening? If God cures all diseases, ignoring the enormous ramifications, then should he stop all fatal accidents? Why would he allow anyone to die? Just because you live to 70 and you die then, how is that fair? Why shouldn't you be able to live forever? And if you live forever and humankind's continue to extrapolate their gang mentality and their irresponsible behavior, how fast would we destroy all life on the earth? And if God were to stop all fatal accidents, then should he stop all random acts of brutality? Therefore, would he eliminate Christianity from the time it was conceived all the way through the Holocaust? Should he have eliminated Islam? Should he have killed every Muslim so they couldn't perpetrate genocide against his people? Wouldn't it be fair if everyone lived to the same age? Everyone dropped dead on their 70th birthday. There you go. You never had a sniffle. Well, it's a slippery slope that can easily result in an existence where there are no bad consequences for any actions, making choice irrelevant for all actions. Why go to work? Why make a contribution? There are two additional thoughts I'd like to consider before we move on to the next statement. First, Yahweh has intervened on occasion to preclude the exercise of free will when he recognized that the cost of not doing so would be catastrophic. Examples include the flood, Egypt's choice to retain their Hebrew slaves, and the eradication of a handful of villages in the Promised Land at the terminus of the Exodus, as well as the elimination of the Assyrian army surrounding Jerusalem at the time of Hezekiah. And yet, God is routinely assailed for these interventions, even though each was merciful. By nipping these rapidly escalating problems in the bud, God ultimately prevented far more grievous slaughters. Each case was not unlike God preventing the 100,000 people most responsible for Hitler's Germany, Stalin's Russia, Hirohito's Japan, and Mao's China from living, thereby saving 100 million lives. While the calculus on these choices would have been undeniably beneficial, the very people who cry out to God to intervene to prevent future perpetrators from harming innocent people criticize him for doing any of these things, ridding the Promised Land of those who were plagued with religion and politics. It's kind of like saying, I want to move into a new home. I'm going to bring my family into the home, but I want to make certain that we feed and nurture all of the rats in the basement that are infected with the bubonic plague. We want to make sure all the vipers living around the property are properly motivated so that they bite on command. It's just stupid. The second ramification of God choosing not to suppress the gift of free will pertains to the Torah, the prophets, and the Psalms. The first crime recorded in God's word is the corruption of God's words. Satan shirked his responsibility for protecting Eden as a cherub, and instead, he left his position on the wall to misquote and manipulate Yahweh's instructions to Chawa. He realized, in having observed her, that she was like him and wanted to be a god. It was easy for him, therefore, to manipulate her because she and he were very similar. Now, I want to make certain that I get this point in, and I'm going to emphasize it many more times. I am really tired of people blaming this mythical Eve for the fall of man. That's not where the blame properly lies. The person most culpable and being booted out of the garden was Adam. Yahweh instructed Adam as to what would be beneficial for him and what would not. It was Adam's responsibility to convey that to Chawa so that she understood it. And because God had given Chawa to Adam to be beneficial to him, he had a responsibility to reciprocate. And she never would have tried to rise up against Yahweh and Adam had Adam been a responsible partner. He was not. Therefore, returning to the garden after setting his trap by playing to her desire, Satan misappropriated Yahweh's instructions, knowing that Chawa would willingly comply. And since God permitted this to occur, why are believers so reluctant to accept the obvious that he has allowed the same crime to continue unabated for millennia? There are tens of thousands of old manuscripts of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms which tell a slightly different story. And as it relates to the Christian New Testament, there are fewer words than there are variances. For those who said, I can't believe God will allow his words to be corrupted. And then they're citing them in the King James, Elizabethan English, as if God spoke English, much less Greek, much less conveyed anything that's in those translations. God, as a result of free will, either allowed his word to be manipulated and twisted, as he had in the garden, or he was powerless to stop it, making such a God feeble in comparison to men who conceived religions by misquoting him. The facts are clear. Clerics conspired to corrupt Yahweh's testimony to serve their religious agendas, and their victims have seldom cared enough to contradict, correct, or thwart them. Both sides of this perverse equation have made a choice and must live with the consequence. So in the next five statements, they serve to locate Eden, which is interesting because they aren't germane to this review. I will pass them by. And if you wish to read about them, you will find the stories that explain where these rivers all commenced, so that you will know that Eden was under what we refer to now as Lake Van in eastern Turkey. But in this particular review, my goal is to focus on the things that help you understand what Yahweh intended with the garden, as well as why Yahweh is bringing us back to it. So we're going to jump ahead and help understand the Sukkah implications with a millennial Shabbat while explaining Yahweh's intent. Yahweh Almighty, relationally, grasped hold of the man named Adam, and he settled him restfully. He placed him, setting him down after settling all unresolved issues so as to foster an association, an alliance. It's a derivation of Ruach, spirit. In the garden, gone, protected, defended, and enclosed, covered place of care and concern of Eden. Great joy, delight, and pleasure. Total satisfaction and a favorable state of great gladness. To minister to her, to work it, to labor in her, to serve her, to cultivate it, and to closely observe her, to pay attention, closely examining, carefully considering what was within it, keeping focused on her. Bereshith, in the beginning, Genesis 2:15. So as noted in the translation itself, I highlighted Nuach, which is to settle. It's a derivation of Ruach, spirit. The associated meaning also serves to highlight the role of our spiritual mother, the Ruach Kodesh, as she purifies, protects, and protects us, settling all disputes between our souls and the Torah so that she can lift us up and bring us into our Heavenly Father's home as members of God's family. It is from this perspective that we can associate the Gan, this protective enclosure for life, and Sukkah shelters. Yahweh's Gan Eden, a joyous garden, and his Chag Sukkah, festival feast of shelters, both describe life in his home. It is important because the path we are invited to walk through the Moed Mikre arrive at Sukkah. It is our destination, and camping out with God is the result. As such, we should look at Pesach, Matzen Bikurim, Shavuah and Teruah, then Kippurim, as providing the way to heaven on Sukkah. Yahweh's seven invitations to be called out and meet with him enable him to Nuach, settle our debts, so that we can Nuach, settle down and live with him in his Gan Eden Sukkah. According to the best etymological resources, Nuach wasn't used to convey rest, as in the absence of movement, but instead to communicate the idea that God's mind was settled because he had achieved what he set out to accomplish, resolving every issue. He not only created a companion and settled him in the joyous garden, but he also conceived the means to an everlasting familial covenant relationship at that moment. In the context of Shabbat and shelters, Nuach represents the security and victory of reconciliation. As such, Nuach was deployed in Bereshith 8:4 to affirm that Noach and his family were saved because the ark Nuach settled safely on the mountains of Ararat after the flood. More telling still, Nuach was used in conjunction with the Ark of the Covenant. And it shall come to be as the soles of their feet of the priest lift up and bear the Ark of Yahweh, that the upright pillar of the land will settle securely and victoriously in the waters of the Yarden, Jordan. Ahosha, Joshua 3:13. There's another insight we can glean from Barashith 2:15. While joyous, delightful, pleasurable, satisfying, and restful, paradise is not about being idle. Adam had a job, a purpose. He was to work. There were things that needed to be done. And that's wonderful news, because lounging around for all eternity wouldn't be my idea of a good time. When I worked my last day in business, the one thing that I dreaded was becoming idle. I wanted to continue to learn, to explore the universe, to be productive and useful, with something to shamar, closely examine and carefully consider. I would delight in the opportunity to accomplish something meaningful with God. And for this reason, I'm quite pleased to see Abad work used in conjunction with Adam in the garden. Work has merit. And we're going to work through more of Yahweh's testimony as he describes the conditions and intent of the garden, and the next program devoted to in the garden. This has been the Yahweh Blog, and I am your host, Craig Wynn.